From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we check back with Roger Cohen, who's been covering the war in Bosnia for the New York Times. He spent most of May and June in Sarajevo, which had been sealed off, all the roads blocked, water and electricity shut off. He managed to get out on June 25th and is taking a brief break from covering the war. We'll find out how he got out, what day-to-day life is like now in Sarajevo, and we'll discuss the latest developments with the UN. The new film, The Glass Shield, about discrimination in a predominantly white sheriff's department, has commentator Gerald Early thinking about his stepfather, who became one of the few black Philadelphia police officers during the 1950s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Police in Raleigh, North Carolina, say there is no sign of a connection between today's mail bombing and the so-called Unabomber. A spokesman says authorities say they believe it's a local situation. Officials say two people have been hurt, one seriously, when a package exploded at the headquarters of BTI, a long-distance phone company. The North Carolina Bureau of Investigation says the package was addressed to the woman who opened it. She was the victim, seriously injured. Package bombs blamed on the Unabomber have killed 3 people and injured 23 since 1978. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi has been freed from house arrest by Burmese authorities. She had been detained for nearly 6 years. Hopes are increasing that Burma's military rulers might ease their grip on power. Representative Bill Richardson of New Mexico says Burma's rulers should be thanked.
I have to give credit to the Burmese government, even though more steps need to be taken in democratizing that country. I always felt that this was a woman in the order of Nelson Mandela and Mahatma Gandhi. Now that she's released without any conditions, she will now take the ranks of leading the democracy movement in Burma. And it's a major step forward. I think we should all be very excited about this, and this democracy of Burma needs to continue with her leadership.
Suu Kyi was arrested in 1989 for leading a pro-democracy uprising that the military brutally repressed. She refused offers of freedom in exchange for exile. The White House, which praised her release, is cautioning that many more dissidents are still jailed in Burma. Chicago authorities say a door flew off an American Eagle commuter plane just after takeoff last night. The plane landed safely, but a flight attendant was slightly injured. UPI's Jay Saper prepared this report.
The commuter plane was bound for Indiana when its main cabin door flew off. No one was hurt except a flight attendant who was bruised. But passengers were so nervous, the airline offered them a free overnight in Chicago. Some took it. Others were so shook up they finished their trip by bus. The airline says the flight attendant heard a whooshing sound as the door fell off and she struggled to hold onto her seat. American is conducting its own investigation. The ATR is the same kind of plane the FAA restricted from flying in icing conditions after a fatal accident in Indiana. Jay Saber, Chicago.
Representative Joe Moakley is undergoing a liver transplant operation at the University of Virginia Medical Center. His office says the Massachusetts Democrat was told last night a compatible liver was available. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 5 points at 4,697. The NASDAQ is up 5 points at 974. This is NPR. Detained human rights activist Harry Wu told an American diplomat today that he's fine and he has not been tortured by his Chinese jailers. Wu, a Chinese-American, met with a diplomat in the central Chinese city of Wuhan today. U.S. officials say Wu gave his statement in the presence of several Chinese authorities, and officials say he may have been forced to hold back information because of that. China has detained Wu for 3 weeks without letting him see a U.S. official. He's been formally charged with stealing state secrets and trying to enter the country under an assumed name. He could face the death penalty. Pope John Paul has issued a passionate defense of women's rights today. The Vatican is gearing up for the September UN Conference on Women in Beijing. NPR's Silvia Pujoli reports.
In a 19-page letter to women, John Paul borrows from both feminist and Christian dogmas. The Pope says there is urgent need to achieve real equality for women in every area, from the workplace to the family to the state. And breaking new ground, the Pope said that while abortion remains a grave sin, the primary blame should be placed on men and society. But John Paul reiterated that only men can become priests because Christ chose men as his apostles. The Pope said this diversity of roles is not prejudicial to women, but is rather an expression of what is specific to being male and female. The letter concludes by saying that in giving themselves to others each day, women fulfill their deepest vocation. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
A new survey suggests prospects for U.S. cities are looking up. The National League of Cities survey finds 72% of responding cities say they took in more than they spent in fiscal 1994. 69% say revenues exceeded expenditures in 1993 also. In contrast, during 1991 and 92, only about half of American cities took in more than they spent. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his last piece on Sarajevo, New York Times correspondent Roger Cohen wrote about a city that had abandoned hope. A city where, when the shelling starts, grave diggers find temporary shelter in the graves they are preparing. Cohen is the Times Balkans bureau chief. He first wrote about the war in August of 92 and has been covering it full time since January of last year. After spending most of May and June in Sarajevo, he has left the Balkans for a month-long break. Earlier today, we called him in Paris to talk about what life is like now in Sarajevo and to discuss the latest developments with the UN. He told me he left Sarajevo because he was exhausted. The last 2 weeks he was there, the city was completely sealed. The Bosnian government opened one road on June 25th, so Cohen decided to leave while he had the chance. But it still wasn't easy to get out.
There's only one way out of the city, and that is over a mountain called Mount Igman. There's a dirt track that goes up the mountain. It used to be used very rarely, but now all the main roads into the city are controlled by the Serbs, and they won't let anyone through. So you have to go over this mountain, and I set out in the early evening and got to the bottom of the mountain at dusk, which is an ideal time because the Serbs fire at the first mile or two of the track as you go up. And dusk is a good time because you can see still and they can't see you as well. However, we were held up at the bottom of the road by the Bosnian army for about an hour and a half because there was some traffic coming down the road and there's not room for cars to pass and everyone's moving at great speed given the danger. So we then had to go up in our armored vehicle at night without lights in pitch blackness. Which is difficult and quite frightening. You can't really see anything, but you can. The track is just marginally lighter than the surrounding countryside, so you are able to inch your way up and hope that the Serbs can't see you with any night vision equipment. There are even some journalists now, Terry, who have night vision goggles for the road,
like the military uses.
Right. But the New York Times hasn't got to that yet.
Do you think that there are many Bosnians who can sneak out in the same route that you used?
Well, you can't get across the airport without a UN pass, which journalists have. There is a tunnel under the airport which can be used by civilians. However, it's quite hard to get the necessary permits to use the tunnel, which is used a lot by the Bosnian military. And in general, it's pretty difficult to get out of the city. In the last month or so, since the Bosnian army launched an offensive that is aimed at trying to relieve the strangulation of Sarajevo, the tunnel has been completely closed to civilians. So there is no way out at the moment for the people in Sarajevo. In better times, the tunnel was used fairly freely, and people could get out. Of course, men of military age can't. And a lot of people, any people who have access to any kind of sensitive information, are generally not allowed to leave. And there are fairly severe restrictions on movement.
Do the Serbs have any respect for the safety of journalists?
I don't think so. More than 40 journalists have been killed during the conflicts in Croatia and in Bosnia. The Serbs fired a rather high-powered rocket at the television center since we last spoke, and several journalists were injured and were extremely lucky not to be killed. The Serbs know more or less what they're firing at, so I think when the television center gets hit, that's probably because they want to hit the television center. Journalists in any war, of course, are vulnerable, but I think in this war, journalists have been directly targeted. There have been many instances of armored vehicles with TV written very clearly on them and the bullet going through the TV sign. Of course, the Serbs do feel that the Western media has been biased against them. They're convinced that their case has not been properly understood and that they've been the object of a large plot orchestrated partly by the Western media. And that may be a reason why journalists have been targeted on occasion by them. It's very hard to try to convince the Serbs that I think most journalists have done their best to try and present both sides of this story. But the Serbian onslaught on civilians has been ruthless and indiscriminate and gone on a long time. And it's hard not to come down and say that flat out at some point.
Roger Cohn is my guest, and he's speaking to us from Paris. For 5 weeks, he was in Sarajevo reporting for the New York Times. The last article you wrote about Sarajevo was, I think, really an extraordinary piece in which you described people burning books to heat their stoves, to cook the rabbits that they were raising in cages in their bedrooms. Have a lot of people started doing that, raising rabbits so that they'd have something to eat?
Well, people are doing whatever they can to find food. They're scrambling around. The United Nations does bring some aid into the city, but it's really not sufficient. Sarajevo is now covered with vegetable gardens. Every conceivable piece of land on the side of roads, on the side of hills, in former parks, has been either converted into a vegetable garden or a cemetery. So on the one hand, people are growing as many vegetables as they can, and it's an extraordinary sight when, after the shelling stops, you see people coming out in the lulls and digging in their gardens and planting things. At the same time, they've also taken to keeping chickens for eggs and also raising rabbits. And these rabbits are raised in cages anywhere they can. Many people don't have any yard or space where they can put the cages, so they just put them inside their apartments. In many ways, these people who a few years ago were living like you or me have gone back a century in time. They have stoves in their apartments, which they heat by any means they can because they no longer have wood. They burn books or they burn their clothes or burn whatever they can. They have no running water, so they go out with wheelbarrows and fill containers of water and try to dodge the shooting and the shelling and fill their bathtubs with the water and use that to make coffee and cook and generally survive. So people are improvising in any way they can, and in general they are, I think, preserving their dignity in a remarkable way. But the sight of the city is a terrible one. And I think in that particular piece, because I'd been there so long, I think some of the sense of suffocation perhaps came through in the piece, and that's why it seems to have provoked a strong response, I think.
Did you worry about identifying too much with the people there, or do you think that there's no such thing in a situation like that?
Well, I worry. I have worried a lot about presenting both sides of this conflict and trying to be an objective journalist, in that that's what we're all taught to be, and that's certainly what I'd like to try and be. However, I think it's important not to confuse objectivity with neutrality. You can be very objective without necessarily being neutral. I'm sure that I have, by virtue of spending long periods in Sarajevo and talking with tens, if not hundreds, of Muslims who've suffered terribly in various ways. I'm sure I have come to identify with them, but I've also spent a lot of time on the Serbian side, and I think I've bent over backwards to try and understand their point of view. It's not the Serbian case that is necessarily difficult to understand. It's the barbarity of their methods, which I find unacceptable.
Now, you mentioned that Sarajevo is filled with cemeteries and vegetable gardens. Are the vegetable gardens communal gardens, and are people very protective of them? Is there a lot of fear that someone who didn't plant the garden is going to raid it and take all of the vegetables?
Yeah, there is some concern about that. These are not communal gardens. They're each person goes out and chooses a small patch of land and begins to till it and plant seeds, and that becomes his or her vegetable garden. Now, quite how the system works, I don't know. They do try and erect small fences sometimes around these patches, but in general, I think, as in most things in Sarajevo, there's a good deal of respect among the people for each other, and I think raids of the gardens are rare, although I have spoken to people who'd suddenly seen their whole carrot or onion or potato crop for the year disappear overnight, and very heartbroken they were about it. So there is stealing of vegetables, but in general I think there's a healthy amount of respect among the people for each other's property.
How much food is the UN getting in?
Right now, very little. The airlift to Sarajevo has been down for over 3 months. That's the longest period, Terry, that it's been down since the siege began in April 1992. Now, the airlift used to bring in 90% of the food aid that reached Sarajevo. After the airlift went down, the UN tried to adapt and was bringing up the amount of food brought in by road. However, as the situation has deteriorated over the last 3 or 4 months, they've been able to get very little food aid in, and the warehouses at the moment are essentially empty. The Serbs, following the standoff after the NATO bombardment and the taking of hostages, have essentially closed roads through Serb-held territory. So the UN is risking coming down that Mount Igman road I mentioned to bring in some food. However, the road is very small and full of curves, and it's not a road you can bring heavy convoys of trucks down with any regularity. So the food situation is pretty desperate. There's no question that the Bosnian army, and I think one has to be clear about this, the Bosnian government and army have opted to take the war to the Serbs at this point. They are fighting to break the siege of the city, they say. They started the offensive a month ago, and this has brought with it a deterioration of conditions for the people in the city. In general, I think if the offensive were to produce some results, the people do support their government in this, but they have been once again led into a more critical situation in terms of just their day-to-day survival by this decision of the government. The government argues that it has no choice, but there is a link between the government's decision and the fast deteriorating situation for the people. It's not just that the Serbs have suddenly increased the pressure. There's been an attack out of and around the city by the Bosnian government.
My guest is Roger Cohen, the New York Times Balkans bureau chief. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Roger Cohen. He's in Paris on a brief break from covering the war in Bosnia for the New York Times. One of the doctors who you interviewed told you that everyone he has seen has a form of post-traumatic stress, whether it's paranoia or denial. Did you notice that too? I mean, would you agree that everyone seems to have incredible stress disorders?
I think so, Terry. I mean, it's the people are under continuous pressure. Now, for example, the banker that I spoke to, Mr. Slivich, he's very calm on the outside. He's quite flat. But the way he lives, there is clearly an enormous amount of denial, denial that the outside world exists, denial of his former life. I mean, he's raising rabbits and watching his tomatoes grow and trying to make sure his kids don't get killed. But this is a man who, before the war, was a bank executive, a well-traveled international businessman, and he's reduced his life to about 50 square meters, say, in a western suburb of Sarajevo, and he just sits there, basically. You see many people whose kids have been killed or whose relatives have been killed, and they're not extremely emotional. They tend to be very flat. On the other hand, you can be involved in what seems to be a very normal conversation, insofar as any conversation is normal in Sarajevo, and suddenly the person will break down in front of you and start crying. So I think the degree of tension is enormous. And I found myself, not that my situation is remotely comparable with those of the people there, that when I come out of Sarajevo after an extended period, I'm very exhausted over a number of days sometimes. And it's a kind of extreme physical tiredness, which I think is the tension just slowly draining out of me. And also this curious process of adapting again to a city like Paris, which is not far from Sarajevo, but which in effect is on another planet.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of people have lost their children in the war. You wrote about the director of the morgue who had to identify the bodies of his niece, his nephew, and then his son.
Yeah, he's an extraordinary man. He's been at the morgue since June 92 as the director of the morgue, and he's personally kept a record in these rather dogged ledgers there of all the people killed, at least in the central area of Sarajevo, thousands and thousands of names. And shortly after he arrived at the morgue, his nephew was killed. Then his niece was killed. And then in the October following his arrival at the morgue, he had to identify in the morgue his own son, Ibrahim, age 22, who had been killed. He would like to leave the job, but the city can't find anybody to replace him. His difficulties have been increased by the fact that his son's wife was pregnant when he died and his grandson was born 3 months after his son's death. Subsequently, his daughter-in-law remarried, or at least began living with another man, and she has now decided not to let, for whatever reason, this boy's grandfather, the director of the morgue, see the child. So he's very, very upset about this and was talking a lot about that when I saw him. So he's a man who's really faced one tragedy after another.
You wrote in that last piece that you filed from Sarajevo that everyone is tired of being asked, how do you feel? And yet as a reporter, you can really most bring the story of the war to life for outsiders by describing the circumstances of individuals who live in Sarajevo. Was it hard for you, knowing that everybody is tired of being asked, how do you feel, to find out how people feel?
Well, there are some things I don't do anymore, Terry. I mean, I see people, reporters, arriving in Sarajevo for the first time, and of course they go down to the water lines where people line up to get water, and occasionally shells fall in those areas, and people over the past month or two have been killed in these water lines, and they ask people how they feel. I did it myself when I first went to Sarajevo, but I can't actually bring myself to do that anymore, because I feel it's very humiliating to the people to be asked, as they stand there, reduced to this rather bestial existence, how they feel to be gathering water, how they feel to be in a surrounded city, how they feel to be without freedom. I tend to try to through friends or friends of friends, go to people's apartments and just sit around chatting for a while and let the conversation drift and see what comes out. I completely understand my colleagues who do go out on the street and ask people how they're feeling. I don't do it anymore, but that's just a personal choice. I do understand why Sarajevans are tired of being asked that. They don't want to be asked how they feel. They want to feel good by being able to travel what used to be the 3 hours to the coast now that it's summer and take their kids to the beach. They want to be able to go out into the countryside and have a picnic. They want to just be normal. I don't think they want more than that. The government, the Bosnian government may want more, the Serbian politicians may want more, all these politicians want this or that, but I think the people on all sides, Serbs, Muslims, Croats alike, in their vast majority, just want a return to some semblance of a decent existence. And I myself tend not to ask people how they feel anymore because I know how they feel in that sense. I find it more interesting just to chat and let the conversation go and see what comes out.
What are the different outcomes the people of Sarajevo see when they look into the future?
I think they've got beyond speculating. They hoped last year when the shelling stopped and the NATO ultimatum was effective and trams ran for a while, and even though the city was not opened up, at least there was an improvement. I think they allowed themselves to believe, although there was always a tiny part of them, or maybe a large part of them, saying it's not over yet. They wanted very much to believe that the worst was over and that Sarajevo was on its way out and Bosnia was on its way out of this long crisis. I saw many people then who were painting their apartments or repairing them, and I'd say, but the war's not over, why are you doing it? And they'd say, well, it's at least a half time and I'm going to take advantage of it. They wanted to think that it was worth redoing their apartments because they wanted to believe it was over or almost over. Now I think that the situation has fallen back almost to square one, to the worst of the siege in 92 and 93. I think they're beyond imagining where this will lead. You often hear them say, when the war's over, I'll do this, when the war's over, I'll do that, and then they'll catch themselves and say, but God knows when the war will be over. And I think they're right. I think this war could now go on for an extremely long time. It's been allowed to fester. It's now, in a way, the first surrogate war of the post-Cold War era. You have the Arab world increasingly helping the Muslim-led Bosnian government. You have the Russians helping their fellow Orthodox Christian Slavs, the Serbs. You have the United States helping the Federation of Croats and Muslims against the Serbs. And everybody is contributing something in the way of money or helping out militarily. And this war has the potential now to go on for a long time. Perhaps it can be contained, but to end it now is going to be extremely difficult.
Roger Cohn is the New York Times Balkans bureau chief. He's taking a brief break from covering the war in Bosnia. He spoke to us earlier today from Paris. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Roger Cohn will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The UN is threatening NATO airstrikes against the Bosnian Serbs. Coming up, we discuss the UN presence in Bosnia as we continue our conversation with Roger Cohen, the New York Times Balkans bureau chief. And commentator Gerald Early has been thinking about the experiences of his stepfather, who was one of the few black police officers on Philadelphia's police force during the 1950s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Authorities in Raleigh, North Carolina, say a package bomb exploded in the fifth-floor mailroom of a long-distance telephone company. Two people have been hospitalized. Sharon Corpening of member station WUNC has more.
A police spokesman says the package was addressed to one of the women who was injured in the blast. She has been hospitalized in serious condition. The other woman, who police say drove herself to the hospital, is reportedly in good condition. Authorities say that there is no evidence that today's bombing was the handiwork of the Unabomber. Police are treating this as a local incident. The bomb exploded at the headquarters of BTI, a long-distance telecommunications company. For National Public Radio, I'm Sharon Corpening in Raleigh, North Carolina.
White House officials say President Clinton is going to announce that he wants to normalize relations with Vietnam. Aides say the announcement will come tomorrow during a ceremony in the Rose Garden. Members of Congress are to be on hand. Among them could be Republican Senator John McCain. He is a former Navy pilot and prisoner of war who spent 6 years in a POW camp. McCain has called on Senator Bob Dole and other Republican leaders to support the move towards smoother ties with Vietnam. Middle East peace envoy Dennis Ross arrived in Israel today for talks with Israel and Syrian officials. He'll try to pave the way for more talks between military officials on both sides. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Dennis Ross's visit comes amid an increase of tensions between Israel and the pro-Iranian Hezbollah in South Lebanon. Ross will discuss Lebanon, where Syria has 40,000 troops, as well as security arrangements surrounding an Israeli withdrawal from the Golan Heights. The Israeli and Syrian chiefs of staff met in Washington last month, but there was no breakthrough. Ross will also meet Israeli and Palestinian officials to discuss the emerging agreement for expanding Palestinian self-rule. Israel and the PLO announced they will move those talks to Italy, which is seen as a neutral country. They say they want to try to escape press coverage and concentrate only on negotiations. The two sides are racing to meet a July 25th deadline for the agreement, under which Israeli troops will pull out of Palestinian cities and Palestinians will hold elections. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Greenpeace claims that its Rainbow Warrior II suffered major structural damage during a raid by French commandos yesterday. It's not clear if the ship is still seaworthy. The environmental group says the Warrior has been towed to the limits of France's 12-mile exclusion zone near Mururoa Atoll. The commando stormed the vessel yesterday when it sailed near the atoll to protest planned nuclear testing by the French government. The Greenpeace protest also comes 10 years after scuba divers belonging to the French Secret Service bombed the original Rainbow Warrior during a nuclear protest. This is NPR. The countdown is underway for a space shuttle mission that had been delayed by woodpeckers. The shuttle Discovery is scheduled to lift off Thursday morning. It was originally supposed to take off 5 weeks ago, but a pair of woodpeckers caused so much damage to the insulating foam on the external fuel tank that NASA had to take the shuttle back to the hangar for repairs. If Discovery lifts off this Thursday as scheduled, the takeoff would be just 6 days after the end of the previous Atlantis shuttle mission. That would be the shortest turnaround ever between shuttle flights. Boeing and European aerospace companies have halted plans to build a new super jumbo jet. The aircraft would have featured 2 floors of passengers and would have been the largest commercial aircraft aloft. Bill Radke of member station KUOW reports.
For the past 2.5 years, Boeing and members of Europe's Airbus consortium have been studying the market for a plane they call the Very Large Commercial Transport that could carry up to 800 passengers. Right now, Boeing's largest jet, the 747, can seat about 500 people. Boeing says it approached foreign companies because of the project's exorbitant cost and because the world market isn't big enough for more than one super jumbo jet. The plane would have been used primarily at airports such as London's Heathrow and Tokyo's Narita, which have expanding passenger traffic but no room to grow physically. Today, the partners said their study has determined it is technically feasible to build a super jumbo, but they say there aren't enough buyers right now to go forward. The companies say they'll review the prospects again next year. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke in Seattle.
Authorities in Seoul, South Korea have raised the death toll from the huge shopping mall collapse. Authorities say 199 people are known dead. The toll is expected to jump since 230 people are still missing. Rescue workers are battling rain, but hope has increased since a 21-year-old man was pulled alive yesterday from the rubble. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with the second part of our interview with Roger Cohn, the New York Times Balkans bureau chief. He's covered the war in Bosnia full-time since January of last year. He spent most of May and June in Sarajevo, left the city June 25th, and is now taking a brief break from covering the war. We called him earlier today in Paris. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening with the United Nations. Right now, the UN is threatening Bosnian Serbs with NATO airstrikes if the Serbs continue to attack the UN safe area of Srebrenica. In the meantime, Dutch peacekeepers who are trying to defend the city, 30 of them have been taken hostage. What do you think airstrikes on Serbs over in Srebrenica would mean?
Well, I don't think there'll be airstrikes.
Well, why not?
Because I think the UN, after the experience of the last airstrikes, where we had more than 300 UN officials taken hostage, the UN let it be known to the Serbs that airstrikes were probably a thing of the past. Now, if the Serbs really bombarded the Dutch position there and there was a large loss of life among the Dutch peacekeepers, that could change. But I think the UN knows that airstrikes will then bring a cycle of reprisals and further violence, and I think it's reluctant to take that course. It's not impossible, but I think it's unlikely. In Srebrenica, what we're seeing is a rerun now. In Srebrenica, in the first months of 1993, there was a Serb onslaught. The UN went in. Since then, every other safe area virtually has gone through this kind of cycle. We saw it in Garajde. We saw it in Bihać. We've seen it recently in Sarajevo. Now it's Srebrenica again. Fact is that the UN cannot stop the attacks on the safe areas. The safe areas are also used by the Bosnian government to start offensives. The UN is caught in the middle of a war. Its mandate would allow it to be forceful, and its mandate defends the territorial integrity of Bosnia, that is the Bosnian government, against the Serbs, but it's never been ready really to interpret the mandate in that way. So it's caught in this hapless way between the lines, trying to help people out in small ways, provide food, cover from snipers, whatever. But essentially, the mission is a mission that is lost.
What's the status of the new rapid reaction force that the UN is mobilizing? Has that force arrived in Bosnia yet?
Well, the status is extremely confused. The rapid reaction force was invented in haste, I think, as a means to get through the hostage crisis. Nobody was ready in France, Washington, London to fight the Serbs or even completely isolate the Serbs over this. At the same time, particularly the British and French governments had to be seen to be doing something. So this force was sent in there without anybody knowing exactly what its mission would be. Right now, you already have, I think, about 5,000 soldiers in central Bosnia. This is a new development. They're wearing green. They're not wearing the white of the United Nations. They have green tanks, green helicopters, green artillery. In theory, they are a fighting force from some of the world's best armies and capable of doing a lot. What Bosnia has taught us is that you can have the best oiled and most magnificent fighting machine, i.e. NATO, and if there isn't the political will, if there isn't the leadership, and that's an important word, leadership, where is it? If there isn't leadership, all that equipment, all that know-how is not worth very much, and this could be the problem with the Rapid Reaction Force. It's there. It's capable of doing something, for example, blasting a road through to Sarajevo, but is the political will there? If history, recent history, is a guide, then the answer is no.
What are the goals of the Rapid Reaction Force?
The official goals of the Rapid Reaction Force are to protect the other United Nations peacekeepers, make sure they're not humiliated, and make sure they can fulfill their mandate. The question, Terry, is which bits of the mandate do you want to uphold? The mandate is not neutral. The mandate in all the preambles of all the UN resolutions, there is this phrase, upholding the sovereignty and independence of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Now, Bosnia-Herzegovina is 70% occupied by the Serbs. The mandate allows the UN to use whatever means, including force, to bring food through to the safe areas. That is one of the basic elements in the mandate. So the Rapid Reaction Force could, if that is what is meant by the mandate, the Rapid Reaction Force could be a very strong vehicle for changing the situation, that is, for opening up some of these safe areas. But one also has to recognize that in doing that, the UN is more clearly than it has ever wanted to taking sides, because all the areas around these so-called safe areas, which are in fact the most dangerous parts of Bosnia, are Serb-held. So to push through, you have to fight a war. And I don't think we want to fight a war. I don't think President Clinton wants to fight a war. I don't think President Chirac wants to fight a war, or Prime Minister Major. They don't think it's worth it.
My guest is Roger Cohen, the New York Times Balkans Bureau Chief. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Roger Cohen. He's in Paris on a brief break from covering the war in Bosnia for the New York Times. The Bosnian UN envoy was quoted as saying, if Srebrenica falls, that will mean the end of the UN mission in Bosnia. What do you think the odds are that the UN will end up pulling out altogether before the winter?
I think there's a chance that could happen, but I wouldn't bet on it. I tend to bet against it. For all its failings, for all its difficulties, I think Western governments, well, for the Europeans, it would be a colossal admission of failure. They've invested hugely in it, the French and British military particularly, and to kind of slip away with their tails between their legs after spending all this money and just leave this European country in the midst of a war would be a terrible admission of failure at a time when Europe has pretensions to look after more of its own security, having lived for more than 50 years with essentially American protection. Now, for the United States, for President Clinton, withdrawal, at least in theory, would involve sending upwards of 20,000 American troops in to help out with the withdrawal. I don't think President Clinton is in the least keen on that. The other element is that nobody wants this war to spread. In a way, they've resigned themselves to the war within Bosnia, and they're afraid that by removing the UN, there would be more of a chance that it spreads. I think, on balance, and it's an agonizing choice to have to make, that a withdrawal would be a good thing. I think it would finally confront the politicians on all sides with their responsibilities. It might lead to very intense fighting over a relatively short period. But I think you'd remove this force that is increasingly being manipulated by all the sides, and you would open the way for this war potentially to be resolved in a relatively short period of time. I'm not sure the war is that deep. That's to say, these people live together for a very long time. Certainly terrible wounds have been opened up in the last 3 years. But I have a feeling that it could all stop, perhaps in a relatively short period of time, if the way were open for that. Of course, the civilian losses, particularly in the eastern enclaves like Srebrenica, could be high, and that is a very difficult decision to take.
How would it change life within Bosnia, at least in the short term, if the UN wasn't there?
Well, there'd be whatever aid is getting through would no longer be there, and this buffer between the armies, such as it is, would be removed. The fact is, however, when the armies really do want to go through, they just go through anyway. I think it would clear the decks. I think, in fact, if you got this force out the way, which is unable to fulfill its mission as peacekeepers, I mean, they're caught in the middle of the war. Almost 70 of them have been killed. Then the equation would be very clear. I think the UN has achieved something. It's allowed the Bosnian army to become credible. I believe that with the possible exception of Srebrenica and Zepa in the east, the Bosnian army can now look after itself. I don't think the Serbs could, as they claim, walk into Sarajevo or whatever. I think the Bosnian army is perfectly capable of holding what it has, and perhaps even doing better than that. So there could be an interest in just clearing the waters are very muddied by the UN presence. Maybe it would be helpful to clear the decks.
The Bosnian government has said it's considering an international brigade of volunteers to fight alongside the government army. What do you think the odds are of that being formed?
Well, that's probably part of the trend I was mentioning earlier of, the Bosnian government is hasn't had support from anywhere else, so the Bosnians have turned to fellow Muslims, and there's been a lot of financial support from Malaysia, from Saudi Arabia, from Iran, from Egypt, Turkey, and there is tremendous indignation in the Islamic world over the way these very moderate, very secular Muslims of Bosnia have been the object of a ferocious onslaught in which, just in the first year of the war, 700,000 or 800,000 Muslims, men, women, and children, were simply chased from their homes and many put in camps. So this is followed very carefully in countries from Pakistan to Tunisia, and I would imagine that the brigade in question would come principally from these countries. Of course, Europeans, I mean, the French are traumatized by Algeria. There's a general uneasiness about Islam fundamentalism, and we saw in Oklahoma, you know, the day after it happened, it was presumed to be some form of Islamic onslaught. In fact, it was nothing of the kind. So there is this fear which the Serbs play on, and it's very unfortunate because you couldn't find, the Bosnian Muslims are Muslims like I am. I mean, they, of course, they've been pushed toward a greater identification with their religion by what's happened to them, but they are essentially thoroughly secular and thoroughly moderate. However, support is growing for them in these countries I mentioned, and that would be, I'm sure, where the military support would come from. This would make Europeans very uneasy.
You're in Paris for a month. And France is the country that has the most troops in the UN peacekeeping force. What is the news like in France now? What's the mood in France about the UN and NATO in Bosnia?
Well, the mood swings back and forth. It's not a burning public issue, I would say. People are still more concerned about 12% unemployment and a generally not very robust economy than they are about Bosnia. However, quite a large number of French troops have been killed, and I think there's a feeling, especially with the new president Chirac, that something's got to change, something's got to give. They've got to do something. I think the political class is floundering, and the people of the country generally indifferent. Certainly, seen from an American point of view, the degree of French reaction to the killing of French boys, the taking of French boys hostage, as we've seen over the last 2 months, is very muted.
In the meantime, for you, you've got a couple of more weeks or so left in Paris before returning to Sarajevo. How easy is it for you to relax, knowing that you're just going to be going back in?
Well, it's not that easy to relax, and it's a very emotional and obsessive story, and I do feel very involved in it. I'm actually going off to Italy at the end of the week on vacation, and there I hope to really try to forget about it for a while. But at the same time, I feel in some you know, tiny way that possibly one or two things I write make some kind of small difference somewhere, and certainly when I get letters from readers, it does mean a lot. So I do feel involved, and I find it difficult to relax completely. There's also the strange fact that Paris is, well, 2-hour flight from Split, and from Split it's a 7 or 8 hour drive into Sarajevo, and here, you know, you go to the market and the difficulty is choosing which kind of mushroom you want or which kind out of 370 different types of cheese, and it's a very it's an odd world we live in. Perhaps it was always like this in some ways, perhaps even during the Second World War. People say that in Budapest, a few hundred miles from various fronts, life at times seemed quite normal. But certainly it's been very instructive in terms of seeing... I've seen a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of insensitivity, and then side by side with that, some examples of amazing courage and amazing generosity and an amazing commitment from individuals. And it's a very powerful journalistic experience and human experience.
When you go back, do you think it will be as dangerous to get in as it was to get out?
I don't think it's going to get any better. I don't think the situation in Sarajevo is going to improve for quite a while. I don't see any inkling of any kind of political solution on the horizon. I see that President Milosevic of Serbia gave an interview to Time, his first for a long time, where he offers himself as a peacemaker if sanctions on Serbia were lifted. I mean, the idea of President Milosevic bringing peace to the Balkans, if that's the point we've reached, I think we're in deep trouble, Terry.
Roger Cohen, I want to wish you a really decent vacation and a very safe journey back to Sarajevo when it's time to go, and good luck when you get back there.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Roger Cohen is the New York Times Balkans bureau chief. He's taking a brief break from covering the war in Bosnia. He spoke to us earlier today from Paris. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. President Clinton spoke today about the issue of violence in the media, the issue raised earlier by Senator Bob Dole. Also, I'll talk with two doctors from a psychiatric clinic in Sarajevo about post-traumatic stress disorder in that city after more than 3 years of war. Sylvia Pajoli reports an open letter from Pope John Paul II to the women of the world, and a report about a man in Ohio who's pleaded not guilty to charges that he bought bubonic plague bacteria from a laboratory, and he bought that by mail. Also, I'll talk with an attorney in South Carolina about the Susan Smith trial in the small town of Union.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Growing up, commentator Gerald Early knew most of the black policemen in his South Philadelphia neighborhood. He says the new film, The Glass Shield, doesn't reflect the experiences of those men.
The recent opening of Charles Burnett's latest film, The Glass Shield, about a black man and a white woman trying to make it on a white male police force, had more than casual significance for me. My late stepfather, a man I knew for nearly 30 years, was a Philadelphia police officer. He joined the force in the 1950s, a time when many big city police departments were beginning to integrate in a major way. Being a policeman was considered a very good job in the black community where I grew up, respectable and well-paying, at least by the standard of most professional jobs then open to blacks. As a boy, I think I met all the black policemen of Philadelphia. No, I exaggerate, but not by much. My mother worked as a school crossing guard and used to pick up her checks from the 3rd Precinct Police Headquarters. Sometimes she would take me with her, and I would get to meet some of the black policemen she knew. This was a big thrill for me, to see the black men in their uniforms, with their holsters, exuding authority. She met my stepfather there, and over the years, a number of black policemen used my mother's small house as a kind of meeting place. I heard them talk about their problems with getting promotions, the prejudice of their fellow white officers, and the difficulty of the job itself. When one was promoted to detective, I remember there was a great deal of rejoicing. He was the same man who taught one of my sisters how to play chess. I remember my stepfather as a conservative man in many respects. He had a low opinion of the people he had to arrest, thought most of them were guilty of what they had been accused of, and was convinced that criminals needed to be severely punished. He was an ardent supporter of the death penalty. He was very suspicious of most people's motives and could uncannily tell when someone was lying. Yet he was a man who had deep understanding of other people's problems and their weaknesses. He probably had a more profound grasp of why people screwed up their lives than any social worker, minister, or psychologist I ever read or heard of. I doubt if he removed his gun from his holster more than 5 or 6 times in his entire career, and he certainly never fired it. He told me that a man should be able to work 20 years on the police force without having to shoot anyone. Burnett's The Glass Shield is about affirmative action, about racist and sexist white fraternities, about conspiracies of various sorts. It is not, unfortunately, the story of black policemen. The black men who joined the police force in the 1950s were tough realists who had served in the armed forces with white men in Korea and knew what working with white men in authority was like. They, by and large, managed to stay on the force and earn the respect of the whites they worked with. Perhaps Burnett did not wish to make a film like Home of the Brave or Red Ball Express or All the Young Men. And surely we do not need another In the Heat of the Night. Showing blacks and whites learning to work together seems too dated, and the police as an institution have always had a certain complex political resonance in the black community. Yet Burnett's film lacks any sense of a black police fraternity and any depiction of how the black community aided its police officers. A good account of the story of the black policeman is James N. Reeves' Black Cops, written by a black man who joined the Philadelphia police force in 1940. I think my stepfather and the black police officers of his generation are heroes. If only someone would tell their story on film as if they were human beings and not political caricatures.
Gerald Early directs the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. He's the author of The Culture of Bruising. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf, research assistance from Becky Cohen. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.